Okay, we should get started. Now, one thing, Dr. Ehrlich is going to have to leave a few minutes later. So if he
early.
Gets up and walks out, it's not that he doesn't like us. He has to. Okay. Then it says here, on when we get to the questions, well, I'll read that later if I remember, that there's an order in asking the questions. First become the members and then so on. Okay.
Right,
so we will start, and we will start with. Okay.
I would wait just a couple more minutes. There's still a session going on.
Okay.
There's going to be a lot more people coming.
Well, Paul is going to have to leave slightly before 12:30.
Yeah, I'm not essential to anything.
So we don't want
to. Get you a car.
They apparently is a shuttle, but I got to be there.
You're going to take the shuttle. Okay.
I'll try the shuttle. If it fails,
the taxi cab is.
Maybe when you walk
a taxi
past
cab
the front
is
door, remind them.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's
so
right.
We don't. I'm used
the
to
shuttle,
everything
said,
always
goes
going
direct
wrong.
Yeah. Without any. Yeah.
So, you know, the protocol for Q&A, right? Journalists and SCJ members first.
Yeah, I just
don't want anybody pontificating from the audience. You guys can go a little later too. Okay, we're supposed to end at 12:30. You can go to about 12:35, maybe even a couple minutes later. Just basically tell folks lunch upstairs.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, well, we're still waiting a couple of minutes, so I will
yes.
mention a
no,
couple
you get the
of things.
I
did.
One
I
is that after it's finished, there is lunch upstairs. And in the question and answers, Society of Environmental Journalists has a policy that members ask first. And then if there's time, then other people can ask questions. Okay.
Email it to me with permission to
so,
use it, if that's okay.
Yeah, then let's get started. Every day seems the same to us, but they're not. Every day there are 227,000 more people living on the planet than there were the day before, like tomorrow. There will also be 68,000 acres of cropland will be taken out of production for various reasons. And what's left will be eroding 20 to 40 times faster than it can regenerate. And every day there are 18,000 children who die of starvation or related causes. 18,000 a day. This is from the World Health Organization. But if a movie dog or TV dog dies, you know, people will get all excited and they will even send flowers to its funeral. In the meantime, these 18,000. So there's a disconnect there between the real world and the fantasy world. Well, with this, it's clear that emotion has more impact. Is it working? It is. Okay, I'm glad that. That emotion has more impact on us than facts and figures do. Well, with this in mind, I decided to write a novel. So I wrote a novel. And to write the novel, I created a world 35 years in the future, and I described this world. Well, in looking at this world, it's very upsetting how the world will have changed in 35 years if we just take what's going on today and project it off into the future. It's frightening. And it really raises some questions. You know, what's driving this? And behind this all, there's some forces that have been driving this. You know, because global warming and a lot of these things will still keep on going, but because all of our environmental problems can be traced to just several causes. And one is population. Another is our lifestyle and how we consume. And this is what's driving the whole thing. But basically, these aren't the things that we look at very much. But how can we resolve our problems when in 2050 there will be like 40% more people living on the planet than there are now, nearly 40%. And how can we ever hope to save the gorillas in the Congo when there's going to be 113% more people living in the Congo than there are now? This is by 2050. You know, how can we resolve these problems? So we have to get down to these causes, and population is half, yet it's treated just as another problem. When you talk about environmental problems, you know, we talk about this, that, and that, and population is one of them. Well, it's not just one of them. But the NPR had a whole year series on this, and I started contacting people, and I found, you know, who are in the population environmental thing. The media just seemed uninterested in dealing with population. And then I got a real sense of frustration out of the people who were dealing with the media, you know, like Population Institute and so on, and what Bill Ryerson is involved with. So I sense from what they said and what they brought up was that there's sort of a taboo in talking about population. And the media has done a very poor job in talking about it. And they just bring it up as just another topic, and they're not even as willing to talk about it as they are of a lot of other topics. It's something that's avoided. Well, we have three very interesting speakers who can tell us some things about this. And can shed some light on this, and they'll probably have some other things to say besides. So I will go through an introduction of them one after the other, and then let them just go ahead and speak. And at the end of the table is Dr. Paul Ehrlich. Excuse me if I read, but I've got a bad memory, and I'm also a bad reader. But anyhow, he's an entomologist from Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford. And he's also the head of the Center for Population Biology, and he's a member of a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. And he has received many awards, and he's written many articles and books, and he's one of the founders of Zero Population Growth, and one of these population organizations that's been trying to do something to wake us all up about these things. And at Stanford, he conducts policy research on population and resource issues, focusing especially on endangered species, cultural evolution, environmental ethics, and the preservation of genetic resources. And then next to him is William Ryerson, and he's currently president of both the Population Media Center and the Population Institute. He received a Master of Philosophy in Biology from Yale University and worked in population for four decades, including 2 decades experiencing adapted the Sabido methodology for behavior changes, change communication of methodology for behavior change communications to various cultural settings worldwide. Among the posts he has held were as director of the Population Institute, the Population Institute Youth Division, several posts of Planned Parenthood, and Executive Vice President of Population Communications International. What to me is particularly interesting are his serialized radio dramas that the Media Center has been producing for underdeveloped nations. He's working to set one up in New Guinea right now, right?
Yes.
And Tanzania and that, where they broadcast soap operas. Through the broadcasting of soap operas, which the people love to listen to, they learn things about dealing with AIDS, the potential problems of AIDS, avoiding AIDS, and of family planning. And then next to me is Tim Wheeler, a journalist. He has a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University, and he now covers the environment for the Baltimore Sun. In his 35 journalistic career, he has frequently written about the environment, including more than a decade as beat reporter for the Evening Sun, now the Sun, and he also did a stint editing the Sun's science and environmental coverage. And during that time, he nearly got fired for approving a column about population growth. Fascinating. Before Baltimore, he worked with newspapers in Richmond and Northrop Folk, Virginia, and the Media General News Service in Washington, D.C. So, we will start with Paul.
When in the 2 hours allotted to me, I'm just going to try and hit some high points. I've been an SEJ member for a long time. I was a reporter for NBC News, and so I'm familiar with a lot of your problems. I would not be so praising as to say that the media coverage of population is poor. If it were poor, we'd be in pretty good shape. It stinks. It virtually doesn't exist. I would point out to you, for example, that I have not seen anywhere in the mass media the obvious and tight connection between population size and growth and climate disruption. More people you have, curiously enough, everything else being equal, the more greenhouse gases you get in the atmosphere. In fact, the coverage, and I'm going to try and make points that I think are not probably so obvious to you, or at least I hope they're not so obvious to you. The coverage of climate change itself stinks. For example, if you go around, and I've done a lot of this, talking to people about what they expect the worst effects of climate change are going to be, what do they inevitably say? They say sea level rise. And I keep saying, look, you know, right here, you're safe. You know, if it gets here, you'll be able to outwalk it. Sea level rise, I'm going to set the bezel so I don't go over my 2 hours. Sea level rise is going to disrupt, if we believe the climatologists, and I do, the lives of possibly hundreds of millions of people. Going to be nothing compared to the millennial change we're going to face now, continuous change in precipitation patterns. And we could go into the details of what's happening, but the starvation level is likely to really rocket. We are faced, for example, in trying to change our water handling infrastructure continuously over a period of about 1,000 years. But, of course, even more desperate than that is our need to change our energy handling infrastructure over the next couple of decades if we're even going to have a chance to fool with 50 or 100 years from now. The connection, again, with population in both directions is really dramatic. And, of course, it multiplies together with our consumption patterns. And I'm not going to go into the details here. I think that Bill will talk about them some. We actually know how to solve the population problem. It's give women an opportunity in every country and job opportunities. And there's lots of things we could do. And the consumption problem, we don't even know what to do. And the politicians all think the solution to every economic problem is more consumption. You're seeing this right now. In other words, they think you can grow out of this problem. How many of you have heard Al Gore this morning? I didn't. I'm curious. Did he talk about anything besides brick in the toilet tank solutions? You know, in California, if you have a drought, you put a brick in your toilet tank, okay? 95% of the water, 90% of the water goes to ag, another 5% to industry. Of the 5% that goes to homes, most of it goes to showers and watering the lawn. But you can cut down one-third of your flushes, which takes care of maybe one-tenth of 1% of the water in the state. If you saw the crawler at the end of his excellent film, Inconvenient Truth. The inconvenient truth was there wasn't a single thing in the crawler that would make really the slightest difference in what happens to the fate of our society. Nothing. Everybody could drive a Prius. The tires could be properly inflated. You could recycle everything you had to recycle. All that would buy us 17 hours more of the world until it ends. So the consumption problem is really tough, and I won't try in my 2 hours to go into the details on that. But the interesting thing is that politicians around the world are very interested now, particularly in the rich countries, in expanding their populations. They, you know, pay you to have a baby and all this sort of thing. Now, this is, you may be familiar with the recent news of Ponzi schemes. This is a Ponzi scheme. That is, it is inevitable when a population slows down its growth rate and then stops growing. You'll get a change in the age composition, which means there'll be more older people proportionally than you had before. And so their idea is keep having babies so we'll have more kids to support the old folks. What's wrong with this particular Ponzi scheme? Well, first of all, the dependency ratio is normally calculated as those under 15 and those over 65, with the ones in between being the working class to support the old people. But, of course, when you get more old people, you get fewer young people. They're not babies anymore. The ones under 15 shrink. And let me tell you, it's a lot easier to get a 70-year-old economically active than a 7-year-old. So one thing that's wrong with it is they don't deal with the dependency ratio. By the way, another group that shrinks are the terrorist and criminal classes, which would be a huge help in California where something like when there's a third of the population is in jail, they're pushing really hard. Anyway, second thing that's wrong with that whole idea is unless you think that the population can grow forever, and I'm sure there are many economists and most politicians think it can, but I could tell you it can't. So it means the age composition change that you're going to face is simply going to be faced by your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren in a situation where you have a much more environmentally degraded and resource-depleted world. So the politicians who are saying you got to have more babies to keep the age structure young just are nuts. But then again, that's no surprise because most of the politicians, they're a sample of the educated people in our nation and elsewhere, and their education on environmental and population issues is so bad they're just pig ignorant. They don't have any idea. They probably never heard of a dependency ratio. They certainly never heard of an ecosystem service. They certainly never heard of the second law of thermodynamics. We educators have done a miserable job. I think there was a Krugman column this morning pointing out how bad it is. And in the United States, how much more money is going in other countries into education. It's probably going in the wrong directions anyway. So you look at the media coverage of population. A couple of years ago, we went through 300 million people in the United States, and every single article in the major media made it look like a triumph, even though I think it was Garrett Hardin said many years ago, if you need more people, they can be produced by unskilled labor that enjoys its work. And there was no problem of running out of people. And no one has ever come up with an even semi-sane reason to have more than 130 million people in the United States. The only semi-sane reason is that we fought and won the largest land war with that population, although if you look at recent events, you can see numbers of people really don't give you military power either. So we celebrated getting into a situation where we're more crowded, where the chances of the numbers of Americans eventually living is shrinking. In other words, we're the country, I'd love to see the country be sustainable and go on for 1 million years, but all these growth promoters want to see it destroyed for their profit and their friends' profit in about 30 or 40 years. Although in many people's view, the country is virtually destroyed now. I'll just say two other things and then turn it over to Bill. One is, talk about lousy press. The Wall Street Journal, I think, was recently attacking me when Norman Borlaug, who I knew, died, saying that he was the person that proved that Ann and I were wrong when we said the battle to feed humanity was over and the population was a problem. The only trouble with the Wall Street Journal is, of course, on their editorial pages, the rest of the paper is pretty good. The editorial page is run by baboons, not smart baboons. And they didn't know, A, that when Borlaug gave his Nobel Prize address, he said, I may have bought a few decades to kill the population monster. He worked in population organizations. And although Ann and I were terribly wrong, curiously enough, there are more hungry people today by far than there were when Norman got the Nobel Prize. And certainly there are more people, there are over 1 billion people hungry today. And when I was born, there were only 2 billion people on the planet, not pushing 7. And finally, if you think it's going to be bad between now and 2050, you are right, but it's going to be probably worse than you thought because few people, certainly it's never appeared in the mass media, know that population growth disproportionately wrecks the environment. Why is that? We're a brilliant species. And curiously enough, when we started farming, we didn't start farming the most marginal lands. And we didn't start, when we started with metals, we didn't start mining copper ore as we do now at 0.5% in some places. And we didn't start drilling down 2 miles to get our oil. We drilled down by putting a pointed stick in the ground in the Middle East or in Pennsylvania. And so what's happening now is every person that you add to the population, everything else being equal, has to get food grown on more marginal land, not on the rich river bottoms where we started. It's got to get ores that are mined from poorer and poorer ores. If you get water, it's got to be purified, transported further, so on and so forth, all of which uses energy. And, of course, our energy use, our level of energy use, is the best single index we have of how much we're screwing up our life support systems. So, on that cheery note, I'll turn it over to Bill.
Paul, thank you. My question for Al Gore this morning, which I didn't get to the front of the line to ask, had to do with his leadership in the population field. Certainly his early article on the environmental equivalent of Kristallnacht that was published in newspapers across the country in the 1970s spoke brilliantly about population. He was the head of the U.S. delegation to the Cairo Population Conference in 1994. But since that time, the world's contribution to support family planning information and services has been cut in half. And just on the climate issue, the UN Population Division's median projection of growth between now and 2050 is 2.5 billion people. Most of those will appear in poor countries with low per capita emission rates, although the U.S. is the third largest increment country in the world after India, number one, and China, number two. And our emissions have tracked one-to-one with our population growth over the last half century. The 2.5 billion, if it comes to pass, is the climate equivalent of adding two United States to the planet. Also, the low and high projections of the UN Population Division differ by about 3 billion. We can, by what we choose to do as a world community, end up with 11 billion or 8 billion. And so that's more than the equivalent of two United States in terms of carbon dioxide output. And in the face of all of this, the world community is cutting its support for family planning. Moreover, what is going on, in my opinion, is a misdiagnosis of, or misprescription, really, of how to solve the population problem. You know, one of the favorite things that Lyndon Johnson said in my book is, after an hour-long briefing on some foreign policy issue by his cabinet, he put his chin on his hands and he said, "Therefore, what?" And that's really the question we're faced with in population. Logically, a lot of people have thought, well, family planning. Well, here's what has happened on family planning. Huge progress, granted. We've gone from 10% of the world's couples using family planning methods in 1960 to 55% today. The 45% non-users outnumber the 90% non-users of 1960 because of population growth. Globally now, with 6.8 billion people on the planet, about 4.4 billion are of reproductive age. 55%, i.e. 2.4 billion, are using family planning methods. Another 2 billion are not. Now, all of the attention of the world community has been focused on 0.2 billion, one-tenth of this group of non-users, who are not using modern methods of family planning and don't wish to have a pregnancy now or in the next 2 years. And the policymakers and donors have concluded, well, the reason they're not using contraceptive methods must be because they lack access to services. However, I've looked at the demographic and health surveys that have been carried out in all the developing countries of the world, and the 200 million men and women who are not using methods of contraception and don't want a pregnancy now or in the next 2 years cite a lack of access about 2% of the time or less, depending on the country. In Nigeria, it's 0.2% that cite lack of access. 0.1% cite cost. The top four reasons, they've heard it's dangerous. In fact, some of the churches in East Africa are giving out information that the lubricant in condoms contains the AIDS virus, so you better not use them. So people are dying from AIDS because they're afraid of using condoms. People are also giving out information that the pill causes cancer, and there's no truth to that. Male opposition is the second reason. Fatalism, i.e., God determined at the beginning of the universe how many children I'm going to have, so why use a method of contraception? God's more powerful than an IUD. And religious opposition. These are the top reasons for non-use by the people who don't want a pregnancy. But how about the other 1.8 billion people? Their reason, number one, is they want more children. And, in fact, when you look country by country at ideal family size, it's quite startling. Fertility rate in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, is 5.7. Among married women, the ideal family size is 7.3 children. Among married men, it's 10.6. This is the most recent demographic and health survey data. If they're going to achieve their goals, they've got to increase their fertility rate. So now there are various reasons they're not increasing their fertility rate. Poverty is one of them. But, you know, if everything were to their liking and they could afford it, they'd increase their family size. And there are many instances, in fact, where economic welfare has led to increased fertility and depression, as in the U.S. in the 1930s and Russia today, has led to decreased fertility. So how do you address these issues of ideal family size and misinformation or cultural factors that are preventing people from using contraception in the first place? This is why, as Peter mentioned, we're doing at Population Media Center soap operas. Now, I've never been a fan of soap operas, and in fact what we're doing in developing countries is not what Americans think of as soap operas. These are primetime serialized melodramas with a bit of a difference. They're based on the policies of each country, and they are designed with not only positive and negative characters that populate all melodramas and battle out over values, but transitional characters designed to reflect and represent segments of the audience, and they gradually evolve into role models for the audience for elevation of women's status, use of family planning, daughter education, avoidance of HIV, and various other social and health goals set by the host country. And we're not taking the goals to them. We're helping them implement their own policies. Using a methodology created by a Mexican telenovela producer named Miguel Sabido, but adapted to radio in Africa and using radio and or television in various countries in Asia and Latin America. And on our website, populationmedia.org, you can find a book that's a free download that gives the methodology. Just one example, given the time frame here, of the results of these kinds of programs. These are all locally written in local languages. And there's a little information in a newsletter on the back table. We did a 257-episode Amharic language radio serial drama in Ethiopia, prime time, 2002 to 2004. We've done four more since then, and we're about to start our sixth nationwide broadcast. The audience comprised 50% of the population of the country. We had healthcare workers at 48 clinics ask 14,400 clients over the course of the 2.5 years why they had come. 63% of them were listening to the program. A quarter of them cited it as the reason for seeking family planning services. Married women who were listening, as we measured from both a baseline and post-broadcast survey, tripled their use of family planning in response to the storyline dealing with that issue. We also had a storyline dealing with HIV prevention, and male listeners went for HIV testing at four times the rate of non-listeners. Female listeners went for testing at three times the rate of non-listeners. We've done similar programs now in 24 countries, and the current most recent success story is northern Nigeria. Kano, Kaduna, Katsina, and Sokoto states are in the far north under Sharia law. The listenership to our second radio serial drama was 72% of adults age 15 to 59, and at family planning clinics, 67% of people seeking services, when they were asked why they had come, named our program by name. So it is doable with information along with services. I'm not saying services are unimportant, but trying to meet or trying to solve the population problem without addressing the issue of demand is an exercise in frustration, because since family planning services have been made widely available around the world over the last four decades, in fact, in the 70s, with great leadership by the U.S., the pent-up demand for the use of family planning has largely been met, at least in cities and large towns in the developing world. And lack of access is only a factor now in remote rural areas. But even in remote rural areas, most people can find a condom or some method. And indeed, there's always the rhythm method, and there are delaying marriage and other strategies that can be used and have been used in the United States and in Europe in their demographic transitions. So motivating people and changing what is clearly an adaptive behavior in a situation of a very high infant death rate of having a huge family with the hope that two would survive, as was the case in India when in 1925 women were having an average of about seven children and two were surviving to adulthood, so India was at zero population growth. But thanks to a huge success story in public health, namely infant and childhood vaccination programs and other public health measures, the infant death rate has dropped to very low rates, and the population growth has taken off. So now the key issue is helping people understand the personal benefits for them in limiting and spacing and delaying childbearing. Thank you.
Okay, we will go ahead with Tim.
Okay. Hi, I'm the working journalist here to provide the mea culpa for why we do such a lousy job, as Paul says. This topic is one that's kind of familiar. If you've been to many SEJ conferences as I have, you seem to have a dim recollection that we've talked about this before. In fact, I think, Paul, weren't you on a panel with Gaylord Nelson and a few other people talking about taboos? And
that was before you were born.
I was the chairman of that conference, 2002.
Yeah, you're a very good kid.
Yeah, I know. Precocious. But so we've done this before, and I can remember having a panel in the 90s on covering population. So why don't we get it? I think it's there are a number of reasons why. I wouldn't go so far as to say I think things are arguably better than they were before. I think in some respects, and in some others they're worse. And I'll sort of trip through that real briefly here. First, you know, the point about them being better. Journalists and media reports do mention population. I mean, I brought a few examples. Here's a press release I got, so this doesn't really count necessarily, but U.S. energy demand on the decline due to population migration. Now, that's a good news story about population, right? Here, these are just from the Baltimore Sun. This was in July. The environmental problem the world is loath to address. Guess what it is? Population. This one's written by a conservative columnist that we have, interestingly. Then this is from a year ago. Population factor, the impact of millions of new arrivals has been missing from the immigration debate. This was an op-ed piece. And then this piece from a little over a year ago, warming called security threat. Intelligence agencies warn of rise in instability, disasters, terrorism. This is the intelligence report on the impact of climate change. If you read through to the last few paragraphs, they mention that dealing with climate change is going to be that much harder as the population grows. So that does get mentioned, but there's a little theme here. One is that most of those instances I cited were op-ed opinion pieces. They were not news coverage. They were not feature stories. And the one news story that I did write about, population, was mentioned as a sort of a complicating factor to a sort of a pressing environmental problem. It's an underlying factor. The issue in some respects is that we journalists tend to deal with the immediate crisis, the immediate story. We have the same sort of myopia, I guess, to some degree that our population, our people do, tend not to look down the road too far. We also sort of, I think, look at this as an issue that's very fraught with, religious and political baggage, issues of abortion, of immigration, of you know, some of the sort of the political questions about how do you actually get your hands around controlling population, and also that sense from somebody, and I work for a newspaper, basically a regional newspaper. We tend to focus on local issues, not national and international ones. So how does a population issue or a problem in faraway countries affect me? Now, that aside, I mean, I have written about the population problem. I can remember doing a feature, One Earth Day, about the population issue. Where things have gotten worse, at least in my world, in the mainstream media, is that my newspaper has been downsized repeatedly in the last few years. There are fewer of us to write stories, and there's less space for stories, and there is less room for as many stories. I dare say if I proposed that feature today, I'd get a blank look. We just don't have a space for it, for one thing. There's a focus on hyper-local information in them. That being said, there is a local impact. We see it, and we've seen it in our part of the world. Just this past year, we did a two-part series, I hope not the last, on the Chesapeake Bay, at one time one of the richest estuaries in the world and the largest in North America. It's been the subject of a 25-year effort to restore it to bring back its fisheries. And we took its measure after 25 years and found that for all the effort and the countless millions that have been spent on cleaning up wastewater treatment plants and trying to improve things, we were pretty much essentially where we were when we had started out. One of the explanations given for that by folks who were somewhat proud of this, the officials were, hey, listen, we've held the line against the growth in population here in the last 25 years. But that's sort of the quandary that you face here with this issue. It's not an easy one to deal with for the reasons I mentioned. We're writing about climate change a lot these days. Population gets mentioned as an undercurrent, as an afterthought. It's, you know, our attention tends to be on the immediate. And it has those challenges of sort of what do you do about it? How do you deal with it? But we're not just, you know, any group of journalists. We're environmental journalists. We write about the environment. It's our task to take issues, and we've done it in other areas, that are slow-moving, slow-developing crises, and examine them and bring them to the fore. So I think it's our constant challenge to continue to try to wrestle with this issue and to deal with it as we can. I don't think, you know, I think we have to deal with the immediate issues. Yes. We've got a conference in Copenhagen. If we start talking about population, they'll never get around to talking about how to limit carbon dioxide. So I think, you know, there has to be some perspective. But that means that we can't afford to ignore that issue, or we're going to wake up, as we have in the Chesapeake Bay after 25 years, and say, after all that we've done and spent, why haven't we made greater progress? Well, it's because there are more people out there. Their footprint is smaller, but there are a lot more feet to cause footprints. I've put a couple of things on the back table. This was, as I mentioned, this is a piece I wrote in 2003 for Environment Writer. Many of you may remember that. It was called Skirting the Population Issue. I went back and reviewed it thinking I would update it, and then when I looked at it, I thought, what's to update? It's pretty much the same story. But there are some examples in there, too, of some good stories that have been done about population, including a series in Florida looking at the growth machine of Florida politics and government, how they encourage real estate development and people moving to the state. The issue, in some respects, is the presumption that growth is good and necessary in order for us to maintain our quality of life. And it's not just population growth, it's economic growth. That's what makes sort of dealing with climate change such a ticklish issue for a lot of people. If we cut back, will we, you know, stagnate our economy? And if we stagnate, will we lose our quality of life? These are issues, I think, that are tough and difficult to deal with, but we need to examine them. There were also a series done by NPR and by The Economist, publications that you're familiar with. I think, you know, we've just got to keep working on this issue and try to do what we can. But it is challenging. Peter mentioned at the beginning that I was nearly fired over a column about population. I'll tell you why I almost got fired. It wasn't because of the substance, necessarily. One of my friends, Tom Horton, wrote a column challenging the assumption that growth was good. It just so happened that we had been writing a whole editorial series about development in Maryland and how they needed to do something about controlling sprawl, and they started every editorial with, growth is good and inevitable, but we have to do something about this sprawl. And he went off, and I was his editor at the time, and he wrote this column, and I said, oh, that's a good column, you know, we'll put it in the paper. And all hell broke loose. The head of the editorial page wanted him fired. I was called into the managing editor's office and read the Riot Act and told, don't you ever, ever put anything in the paper that, you know, contradicts the editorial position of the paper. Now, that's interesting because we're supposed to have a firewall, right? But this is what I learned, and not long after that, I stopped being an editor. So maybe in some respects, my reluctance or my only occasional dalliance in this is because I burned my fingers once, and I've, like a kid, you learn to stay away from the fire. But it's an issue that you know, there aren't a lot of politicians talking about it, not a lot of government officials talking about it, and for a lot of us, when we cover an issue, we look for people to represent the issue, people to talk about it, and there's a silence in the official community about it as well. My last point would be, I recommend his work to you. This is an interesting phenomenon that they're working on. If it's having an impact, maybe this is a story.
Okay, we will now go to the question period. And I have a sign here that says to me, please repeat the questions asked. Okay. Well, we already have some questions, right?
Remember to tell them.
Okay, we have some questions already, and I think maybe I'll start by taking some near the front. So if you can actually speak loud enough that we pick, if this is being recorded, so do you think you can speak loud enough that it'll be picked up?
We need to.
It's better just to repeat the question.
Identify yourself too.
Yes, and identify yourself, please.
Hi, I'm David Seinkraus from the Journal Times of Racine, Wisconsin. William Ryerson, your project in East Africa. I'm going to assume that you did your survey not too long after the broadcasts aired.
That's correct.
Did you do a follow-up survey later on to see whether the message stuck?
The question was basically, how long is the impact of our programs? We did a survey, you're correct, immediately after the end of the broadcast of our program in Ethiopia, and then the question was, did we do a survey sometime later to see if the effects had stayed the same? In fact, not only did we do continuing surveys, and I skipped over for time reasons some of the other studies I've been involved with in Tanzania where we did annual surveys for a period of 5 years, but the Demographic and Health Survey, which is something carried out by Macro Systems International with support from USAID all over the developing world, conducted a survey, and they do surveys about every 3 to 5 years in developing countries. And in some of the countries where we have done programs, they have asked specifically questions about listenership to the program, as well as the standard questions they ask about desired and actual fertility rate and so on. So the data that we have gathered, imperfect as it is, there's not enough funding for research in the area of various interventions and their effects on fertility decision making, is that the effects are long-standing, that they lead to permanent changes in social norms. Now, clearly, in a situation in which the countervailing messages in the culture are overwhelmingly in the opposite direction, there may be a reverse effect. For example, in Kenya, where one of the early Sabido-style radio serial dramas from 87 to 1990 coincided with a 58% increase in contraceptive prevalence and a drop in desired family size from 6.4 children to 4.8. The effects of the Bush administration decisions on withholding funding for family planning led to a closure of a third of the family planning clinics of Kenya. And there has been no continuing funding for communication initiatives promoting family planning and small family norms since the 90s. Fertility rates have gone up as a result of these two factors. So It is probably incorrect to say that once you have an effect, it is permanent. But it's very clear that communications on an ongoing basis are at least as important as ongoing provision of family planning services in order to help countries move towards improved reproductive health, improved status of women, and achievement of smaller family norms.
Okay. How about way back there?
Totally trivial and looking at the global situation. Very important in local situations. Oh, sorry. The question was, if we changed our adoption rules, would that help? It would help a lot of people, but it wouldn't have any significant impact on the global environmental situation.
Okay. Do you think you could maybe come down a little bit?
Okay. I'm Corliss Karasov. I'm a freelance science writer for actually a couple publications right now. This is both to Bill and to Tim. Considering information we now have about the rise of fundamentalism in all religions throughout the world, do you have any statistics to show the impact, the relationship between the rise and the effect in each country? Is there a direct connection that we can see? Also to Tim, wouldn't you assume, I'm just assuming this, that there is some sentiment amongst journalists that you kind of don't trample on anything religious, dealing with population and religion, when you're dealing with science, that we kind of back off a little bit. We're a little bit afraid to get into that.
Thank you.
I guess I won't repeat the question since it was in the microphone. The short answer is no. One way of describing fundamentalists is no fun and damn little mental. And indeed, the impact on provision of family planning services of fundamentalism within the Bush administration was evident. Nevertheless, the mullahs of Pakistan and the mullahs of Iran have been speaking out in favor of family planning use. And indeed, a number of Islamic scholars have issued official findings that while the Quran does not mention family planning per se, the call for women to breastfeed their infants for at least 2 years inherently endorses use of family planning, because in a low-nutrition society, if you become pregnant, the breastfeeding stops. So there are people within Islam and certainly within Catholicism who speak in favor of family planning, and indeed the Vatican in its own backyard has been remarkably unsuccessful, since both Italy and Spain have among the lowest birth rates in the world. So I think that fundamentalists have not had the impact. And indeed, while there have been some reversals of progress, as I mentioned in Kenya, generally worldwide family planning uptake has continued to gradually increase, and fertility rates have continued to gradually decrease.
And to answer your question briefly about the impact of religion, the short answer is probably so. We tend to sort of shy away from talking about politics and how much money people make. And religion is probably the biggest hot-button item. But we're environmental journalists. What we cover is basically connected to everything else. And so I think it's a challenge to look at why people behave the way they do. And that's part of the issue. Another reason we don't write about population or shy away from it is because of some of the people who are telling us we should write about it. And that's sort of a little bit, there are those folks who are hung up about immigration because they are not terribly fond of the immigrants that are coming in. So that makes you sort of discredit or discount what they tell you. And I think, again, we have to get beyond the messenger and look at the message in a way.
Okay, we have a question back here. Yes, you.
Okay.
There is a very good question, and that is, why is it all the talk about third world babies when we are in the most overpopulated nation in the world, when everybody should see the decline that's starting in European populations as a great bonanza? Hey, I should have mentioned that before. It's one of the most wonderful things that's happening. The place we need to reduce population as rapidly as possible is among the super consumers. And yet, for example, there's been a backlash. The press actually has been doing better on population, and there's more movies and so on it in recent years. And so a whole series have come out saying, nah, it's not population, it's consumption. But they don't mention that one of the things you could do is reduce the size of the populations that are the super consumers as fast as possible. And when we're talking about, one of the things that was just raised is how horrible the immigration debate is. And there is a racism element in it without any question. There was racism in the original population movement back in the 1960s and so on. The problem we face now is getting the world organized to talk about these things. And it's not going to come from above. It's not going to come from the universities or from the press. We've started a thing, but write down mahb.stanford.edu. That's the mob. We're starting a bottom-up program because all the scientists I know who deal with environmental issues think we know more than enough science, including the social science that your skin color doesn't tell you what your quality, tell what quality is, all the way through what we ought to be doing about greenhouse gases and population. The issue is human behavior. In other words, we need a millennium assessment of human behavior in which the entire world gets together with also social scientists and people in the humanities involved to talk about these issues. And until we get that kind of discussion about the ethics of many of these things, in other words, is it ethical for us to use the resources that future generations are going to need? Is it ethical for us to stand by while kids die of starvation in Darfur when we have a great problem of obesity in our country? We don't have a national discussion of ethics. We don't have a national discussion of things like social discount rates. It pollutes everything we do, and we've got to short-circuit it. And when you're talking about our problems, you got to look at the distribution of power in our society, which is never basically mentioned. Occasionally it comes up when we see somebody getting a $100 million bonus for running his health organization so well that more people die quicker, part of the health plan in the United States. But so go to the mob, join the mob, get interested in these issues because they're tough issues. They're really tough, and you can't blame the journalists for, as we just saw, a beautiful example. If a journalist tries to do the right thing, who runs the newspaper? Who owns it? Who sets the standards? Why do you get these nonsensical things on the false news network and they never discuss issues like, does Rupert Murdoch actually make love with kangaroos? Nobody knows for sure. So you got to get around this. Anyway, end of sermon.
Just one quick addition. For some time, a lot of journalists have talked about the so-called birth dearth in Europe and Japan. And indeed, Germany is now paying $13,000 in incentives per German baby born. And many other countries are paying incentives all the way over to Mongolia, paying $25 per baby born. You have to wonder what kind of parents respond to such an incentive. In fact, in Mongolia, I'm told, people are having babies for the $25 and then turning the child into orphanages. So this policy and use of public funds must be questioned in an era of climate change. Why is it that we are trying to promote additional creation of additional consumers in the most consumptive and emitting of greenhouse gas societies on the planet, while the globe is still growing by the equivalent of a new Egypt every year? It's just insanity. And I think more and more ecologists are speaking up about the fact that this strategy of trying to keep the growth machine going rather than celebrating stabilization of populations and living in a stationary population, that's a demographic term, non-growing population, on a sustainable basis on the long term is what all societies must strive for rather than trying to grow until we collapse.
Here we have a question. Yes.
Thank you.
I don't know ideal. The question was, do we have any data on the United States and by implication other developed countries where these demographic and health surveys have not been carried out on ideal family size? And what is the impact of the economic recession on fertility rates? I think the answer is we don't know a lot of details on ideal family size in the U.S. At least I don't. That data may have been gathered through surveys, but there is nothing equivalent to the demographic and health surveys in developed countries. I do think it is probably safe to assume, as with the Great Depression in the 1930s, that fertility rates in the United States have probably felt some impact from the recession. But again, I don't know if that data has been gathered, if there's been sufficient time, since it's only a year since the downturn, to really know.
Yeah, I don't know any data either. Of course, you do have the data of what the family sizes are, and they're lower in Europe than they are in the United States for a variety of reasons. But the interesting thing is, despite the President's Commission that I testified in front of in 1972 and so on, which said there was absolutely no point in any further population growth in the United States, it could only be harmful, and at that time we had maybe 200 million people, we stand aside. All of the underdeveloped countries virtually are in better shape in terms of having population policy and thinking about these issues. The U.S. stands out as a glowing example of the most overpopulated nation in the world, because we have over 300 million people. We're the third largest in terms of actual numbers of people. But when you put into the IPAT equation, you put the multiplier of our per capita consumption, we're by far the most overpopulated nation in the world. Can you see a president getting up and saying, you know, if we want to have a better country, if we want to have a better world, if we want to have the resources that everybody needs and we want to have our fair share of it, we've got to get a population policy in this country, that patriotic Americans should stop at 2? That'll be the day. But when you think of that problem, how do you get that done? It'll never come out of the politicians. It's got to come up from the people who finally get fed up with what's going on. And I think we may be closer to that than you think, because the recent economic turns have, I think, illuminated the situation to a lot of people.
Well, I would just like to make a comment on this subject. By going to Global Footprint Network or .com, you can see the effect, the footprint of everybody on it. You can see our American footprint, where we stand, how much more consumption, we're doing per person than anybody, any place else. So you can find that on the internet. Do you have a
question was, where has the funding for, I won't use the term population control because that's often misconstrued to mean somebody's telling somebody else what to do, but where has the funding come for family planning programs? Who are the donors? And the second part of the question was, how has that money been used? The second part of the question is, how do you avoid the political minefields related to raising those funds for family planning? On the first part of the question, the governments of the developed world have been responsible for about a third. Now, you can get this data exactly, but it's roughly a third of the support for family planning assistance in developing countries. And the developing countries themselves have been responsible for about two-thirds of the support. Both groups have failed by huge margins to maybe 50% margins to actually contribute the amounts that they pledged at the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo. So it's been a huge failure of the global community to address these issues, in part because of ideologies getting in the way of adhering to those agreements. And so, in fact, dealing with the political minefields, as you put it, has been tough for the global community, as evidenced by the various problems the UN Population Fund, otherwise known as UNFPA, has had during the 8 years of the Bush administration, when repeatedly State Department missions sent by the administration to China to look into the charge by the administration that UNFPA was in some way collaborating with China's one-child policy, these missions repeatedly found those charges to be false, and yet the administration withheld funds the entire time of the Bush administration from UNFPA based on that unsubstantiated charge. So the desire to make political points by using population and family planning issues as a political football has clearly been a great difficulty in mobilizing the funds that are needed. Thuraya Obaid, the executive director of the UN Population Fund, maybe 2 months ago, announced that what is really needed now is about $65 billion a year in funding for family planning information and services and related reproductive health services globally. And we're nowhere near that figure, but that figure is less than the cost of half of a year of the war in Iraq. So if the population issue is as important as some of us believe it is in terms of its overall multiplier impact on various environmental problems, to have the global community failing to muster that amount of money is a statement that the global community sees it as less important than continuing the war in Iraq, which is a huge statement of what our global and U.S. policies are. So there's a need, even with the new administration, which has restored funding for family planning, to greatly increase the financial commitment so that the world can get on with the business of, in fact, helping women and men achieve reproductive health and helping many people achieve goals that they currently are unable to achieve.
Tim, do you have something to say on that?
Not really.
Okay. Thanks. Another question? Right here. Oh, you can.
Hi, I'm Chris Woodside. I'm a freelance writer. And it's very hard to get editors interested in conserving energy. I think they think we're being nerdy, and I wish that I had an assignment for every time someone said they liked that idea. So I want to ask you, inspire me to keep trying, because my understanding from the writing I have succeeded in getting published and the research I have done is that per capita energy use in this country is certainly not going down. It's going up in many areas, and so the population is a big deal, but could we talk about consumption for a minute? And then how could we get the editors to care?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think consumption is important to talk about. And certainly, you know, the United States, in terms of energy consumption and consumption of almost everything else, you know, has a much bigger footprint on a per capita basis. And that's sort of an example of the immediate issue versus the long-term one. Because, you know, once you deal with that, you still have a growth because you have more consumers. But, you know, I think you can do both. You can deal with both and maybe put both in the same story. But the issue is consumption and how many mouths there are, how many hands out there are. But, I think it's a legitimate story. And especially now in the context of climate change, it's huge. If I were your editor, I'd say, let me see your idea.
But I would just like to make a comment regarding this, and that is, you know, I said that population, lifestyle, and consumption are these multipliers. And one thing that's also not talked about, and that is lifestyle. You know, who dares? You know, what politician is going to say we've got to live more simply? You know, but if we don't, if we insist on living like we do, in fact, increasing our life, our standard of living is what's being talked about, and then all of the other people of the world feel, well, they have a right to live like we do too. This is a big thing of silence. The only people here who talk about it are sort of way out environmentalists and so on. Maybe
I'll just add one item, which is there is no great demand by the public to reduce our lifestyle. So really what is needed is improvement in efficiency and indeed finding ways to reduce overall consumption of energy and emission of greenhouse gases and other pollutants at the same time as we address the driver of population growth. As I mentioned earlier, U.S. emissions have basically tracked one-to-one with U.S. population growth since 1970. Per capita rates have not been cut very much despite a huge amount of effort to do so. And there is a great need, since the planet is finite and the rest of the world wants to live better than they are living, and indeed places like Ethiopia clearly have a right to improve their lifestyle. Places like the U.S. need to reduce their consumptive and wasteful patterns at the same time as addressing domestic as well as global population issues.
I mean, if I could just throw in one thing. I mean, I think, again, one needs to look for the teachable moment, the news hook. And there is one here, frankly, the recession. And there has been, you know, some evidence that people have consumed less because they got less to consume, you know, with which to consume. Just recently reported that, you know, the average new home actually shrank in size for the first time in a long time. That's evidence that people are, you know, however incrementally, looking to live more simply or at least less expensively. During our, you know, recent spike in gas prices a year or so ago, you know, people stopped buying SUVs. They were buying cheaper cars. That, of course, has changed again because prices are down. But it's an opportunity to sort of talk about this. People are doing this because it's seen as an economic necessity, but maybe there's a good environmental upside to it, too. It's an opportunity to sort of bring that out as a case in point.
I cannot resist adding something else, and I think that is about lifestyle, that we have to change it. And we can change it, and we find out there have been a lot of studies made about happiness. And these studies have shown that the more you have, it doesn't increase your happiness. In fact, even sick people, people with bad diseases and stuff, they've studied them and their happiness, and they find out that they reach a certain level, and they find happiness too. And so we have to find new values. It's not just, you know, how to make everything do more efficiently and things like this, but we've got to look at ourselves and say, my gosh, you know, this is, you know, is this all there is to life? Is having a lot of stuff, and that I can live without all this stuff and be perfectly happy? Well, I'll shut up. We have.
Assuming.
Identify yourself.
My name is Steve Holt. I'm a freelancer in Oregon who does mostly photography. Assuming that we make it 30 years from now, and we have transitioned into renewable energy and all sorts of wonderful utopian things that happen, what should we aim for as a sustainable level world population?
The question is...
Now, this is obviously a... You know, there's a whole lot of assumptions here.
The question is... what should we aim for as a sustainable world population, assuming, say, in 30 years we're still around? And there are some very serious exercises going on to try to identify a number. Of course, because of changing technology, a number for sustainable population or carrying capacity of the planet in any given lifestyle is a moving target. the Global Footprint Network and a sort of offspring of their work, something called the Sustainable Living Planner, which is a project and design of the Population Institute, is looking at various choices one can make for level of biodiversity and wilderness maintenance and various other choices that affect that sustainable number, along with lifestyle choices. Perhaps the simplest answer is the work done by David Pimentel, an ecologist at Cornell University, who looked at what would be a sustainable number given a lifestyle more or less on the par of Western Europe, and came up with a figure of 2 billion compared to our current 6.8 billion. So clearly, as the Global Footprint Network has also identified, we are in serious overshoot, and you know, we're taking money out of the bank at a much faster rate than it's going back, particularly water, fresh water supplies. You know, India's water table is sinking by 10 feet a year, and as India's farmers use that water for growing the crops, the Green Revolution crops that need a lot of water, along with cheap oil-based fertilizers and pesticides to feed the still-growing population, adding a new Bombay equivalent a year in India, you know, they are facing a cliff that's getting closer and closer in terms of agricultural sustenance. So whether we can have a soft landing at a number like 2 billion is a very big question, because it's going to take a long time to get there. I mean, the projections are continued growth at least through 2050 and most likely beyond, in part because of neglect of the population issue over the last half decade, I mean, last half century. So the efforts that have been made in this area are somewhat theoretical, but indeed the 2 billion number is probably the quickest answer because of the work of David Pimentel.
I'm sitting in as moderator for a moment. Any more questions? Yes, in the back.
The question is, given the math that's involved in things like the exponential function and other types of calculations used in the field of demography, how do you translate that to a general readership? And it's tough, and I think it's one of the reasons population has been neglected, because people's eyes glaze over when you start talking numbers of 2 billion and 4 billion and so on. Lord Caradon had a poem about this, which was as follows: "It is really no use in the end to be a demographer's friend, for he's given his heart to a graph and a chart, and at night he sleeps with a trend." I think while startling figures can wake an audience up, they also may misinterpret them. But, you know, one of the more startling things I've heard, and I've been in the population field for 40 years, was a calculation done by the founder of the Stanford Knowledge Lab that was presented in a Washington, D.C. workshop last Sunday, in which he had calculated the gasoline price equivalent of price of oil, just so we Americans could understand what he was talking about. And he said, you know, of the 6.8 billion people on the planet, about 1 billion are living at a dollar a day or less, and they're spending about 90% of that on just enough food to survive. So he sat down and he figured out, given what happened with the price spike in oil 2 years ago, and what that did to doubling and tripling of grain prices around the world that led to food riots all over the world, what would it take to tip that billion people into starvation? And the quick answer was, when gas hits $6.50 a gallon, a billion people are going to starve, and then you're going to have the people living on $2 a day at the front of the line, because prices of gas and oil may go up further given the declining production in many countries and the growing demand. So there are some ways to frame the numbers in a way that a general audience can get it, but in fact you can tell stories. We often tell, of course, we're doing soap operas, so we're trying to tell stories of individuals rather than, you know, doing a soap opera about demography, which would be god awful boring. And you can illustrate some of these numbers through storytelling about individual women and men and what they're struggling with. But ultimately, trying to capture these kinds of data, I think it is important to at least sneak that into your articles. The question is, have I tried to get a message to Oprah regarding consumption and population issues? And the answer is sort of. I actually sat down with the head of King World International that exports Oprah and other talk shows all over the world, because he was interested in our using the Wheel of Fortune model as a way of getting people to hear questions and answers about population and reproductive health issues. And so I said the word Oprah, and he said, forget it. So, you know, she is well protected. On the other hand, there was a meeting of billionaires hosted recently, I think it was about 4 months ago, in the New York area, of which she was one, along with Bill Gates. And this meeting was held in secret but reported on subsequently. And the report said that at, I think, the dinner table during this weekend retreat, these billionaires discussed what do they see as the world's most intractable problem. And the answer was they agreed population was the biggest problem. So Oprah is, in fact, among a group of people who see population as a serious concern, but I have not yet appeared on her show. I'd love to. If you have her number, give me a call.
Okay, this is the last one because
Ben's just here.
We're a wee bit over, but it's okay, and then we'll have.
Shall I take this? The question is,
to say something too,
the question is, have we reached an unsustainable level, and if so, what do we do about it? Incidentally, Fish and Wildlife Service has been supporting our storyline regarding preservation of mountain gorilla habitat in Rwanda in our soap opera there. The answer to your question is the global footprint network's calculation is that we now need about 1.4 planet Earths to support our current population at its current level of lifestyle, and that means on water and various other resources and the sinks that handle our pollution, we're using more than can be sustainably used. And so, indeed, if that calculation is correct, there will be a reduction in the human population or a reduction in their lifestyle or both. Now, it's our choice as to how that happens, at least to some extent. You know, we can work to stabilize population numbers and go into reduction of numbers fairly quickly through putting significant funds into information and services, or we can just allow the population to continue growing and crash. And I'm not suggesting in any way, and in fact vigorously oppose any attempts at coercive measures. They don't work, and they're violations of human rights. But we have so far failed to do as a global community what needs to be done to address population issues. And I think most people who stop and think about the trade-off between numbers and lifestyle conclude that the ultimate goal for a sustainable planet is not to have 10 billion people living the Ethiopian lifestyle, but rather to have a smaller number living healthier and well-off or more well-off lifestyle. And so working towards that number is very important. Whether we can avoid a huge increase in the death rate is something I don't know, but it's clear to me that if we do nothing more than we're doing now about family planning information and services, that may be the ultimate outcome. So the world community is, by its action or inaction, going to make a choice in how much human suffering there is, and for that matter, how many mountain gorillas and other endangered species we leave on the planet after we consume what humans need to consume to stay alive.
We have to finish, but I can't resist making one comment while that's sitting here. We are going on from day to day in that, but it is not sustainable the way we're living right now. It's not just a danger for the future, but it's the same as if we live on a bank account and we're living off the principal and drawing it down. That's what we're doing with the planet right now. So, any other quick comment before we go?
Report to your nearest recycling center.
And for food.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you all.
Well, I got a question for you, though. Maybe I should have asked this during the panel. Yeah.